James, it's great to see you again.
Great to see you as well.
Thanks. Why don't we just start with a brief intro of you and Cascadia, and then we'll just dive into some topics around like deals and what you're seeing in the D2C market. Does that work?
That sounds like a great plan. So by way of introduction, my name is James Kartalis. I'm a managing director with Cascadia Capital. I lead the firm's consumer, retail, and e-commerce practice. So Cascadia is a 75-person investment banking firm. We're headquartered in Seattle, Washington. We've got 5 offices around the country. And what we do is we help growth-oriented companies optimize their capital structure and then ultimately exit events. So about 75% of my time is spent advising management and shareholders of privately held lower middle market companies on the sale of their businesses. And so over the last 4 or 5 years, we've really seen an increase in the M&A space for e-commerce first brands and retailers. Hmm. The other 25% of my time is focused on raising growth equity capital for similar businesses. So that's typically done, as a minority investment, non-control, but where, a founder is not ready to sell their company yet, but needs some capital to help invest in certain growth initiatives, or in some instances, just, recapitalize the business a little bit and maybe take a few chips off the table. We work on those deals as well, but so I think the common theme throughout all of my client base is really growth. And we're not in the business of financial engineering. What we really do is we focus on quality growth stories, and then we try to match them up with good strategic or financial partners who buy into the story and want to basically be invested in that business.
Nice. So what would be like a typical deal size, but revenue size of the companies that you work with?
It ranges. The way that we look at the world is our clients need to be kind of institutional grade, in the sense that we don't go out and raise money from individuals or traffic in that market. We're not crowdfunding deals for people. We're working in the institutional market. And so this is typically private equity firms or larger, either sponsor-owned or publicly listed strategic acquirers. And so the targets that they're usually trying to buy, from a valuation standpoint, we call it $50 to $500 million. That's the lower middle market where we play. Okay. From a revenue standpoint, it's going to vary, because valuation tends to be a function of the growth rate of the business, the margin profile of the business, and then in the e-commerce world, some of the other KPIs and metrics, including your repeat purchase rates, your cohort performance over time, and what you can demonstrate from a customer lifetime value standpoint. Mm-hmm. So there's not a one size fits all, but I would say, typically the smaller end of our client base is going to be 30 or so of revenue, and it goes up to, could be $200-300 million, depending on the market profile of the business.
Well, I'm glad you brought up valuation, because everybody loves talking about valuation. So, what you described, kind of a mix of revenue growth, margin profile. I assume that means profitability, but maybe not. So how do, investors or buyers think about those things? Is there sort of like a minimum hurdle of growth and minimum hurdle of profitability? Is it they blend them together?
Sure. So we think about it in a few different parameters, I guess I would say. First and foremost, growth is what everyone is after, and growth is what drives multiple expansion. Businesses typically are going to be valued on some type of a multiple of current financial performance. What we've seen increasingly is a migration in the e-commerce space towards valuing businesses off of a contribution margin or EBITDA margin metric. If you go back 5, 6, 7, 8 years, I don't think investors were quite as in tune with some of the unique realities of what it takes to be profitable in e-commerce. And so you saw deals that were getting priced off of revenue multiples. And to a certain extent, every revenue multiple implies a multiple of earnings or steady state earnings. But what you found was that there were a lot of companies that were chasing growth, wanted to kind of try to be the number one player in the market. And so we're seeking growth at all costs. And that ultimately led to some poor investment decisions because they lost track of the key metrics around their business. And they were bringing in, you know, new customers at the top of the funnel, but they were low quality customers that weren't sticking around. And what I think has transformed in the last 5 years is that people have really started to recognize that e-commerce as a channel is so massive. You don't need to be the only player. And in fact, in many respects, being niche is more attractive because your SEO can perform better. You can be more targeted and you can really compete with the Amazon, you know, you can compete with Amazon if you have a real specific niche or brand that you own. And so as folks have made that shift, they've really focused on profitable growth. And that is the most valuable type of growth that is out there in the market. Now, certainly, there are still instances where people are, you know, maybe just breaking even, but they're truly reinvesting in their businesses. And those are okay stories. And, you know, what we do in that instance is you sort of look at, in a 2 or 3 year time horizon, what would the normalized earnings potential of the business be? What is the margin going to look like at that point in time? Can this business deliver, you know, a 10% bottom line or a 20% bottom line? And then you can kind of back into, you know, what a appropriate multiple for that business would be today. But the broader point is that there's been this shift in thinking, and now investors and buyers are really focused on, you know, is the business making money today? And so these businesses have tended to trade a little bit more off of EBITDA versus revenue, like they used to.
You mentioned earlier contribution margin. When would somebody apply a multiple to the contribution margin?
Sure. So, where we always try to position that is where you're selling your business to a strategic acquirer, because in that instance, if you're a growth stage business, you know, say you're doing $30 or $40 million of revenue, you need to have certain functions to support that, you know, back office, administrative functions that realistically are just not relevant for a business that is a scaled platform that may be bolting on your company to it. And so in that instance, you know, we're always going to push people to look at the actual contribution margin of the business, you know, basically gross profit, less freight and fulfillment, and then value the business on that basis.
Interesting.
Because that's the type of cash flows that they would be receiving in reality.
All right. So I'm going to like hold your feet to the fire a little. Like you said, a 10 to 20% EBITDA margin would be good. Or is that sort of average? Or what's the range of getting people interested in an EBITDA margin?
Well, that's going to depend on a couple of factors. You know, the first and foremost is what's the category that, you know, the business is in.
Yeah.
And so what are the, what do the peers generate? If you look at the, you know, maybe the closest public comp or understand that. So, I mean, what's the sheer gross margin potential for the business? And that's also going to depend on the positioning of the brand. Is it a premium brand? You know, can you garner a premium price from your customer? Will they pay more for your product than they would pay for a generic version of your product? Mm-hmm. Right? And so directionally, you know, best in class gross margins are going to vary from, in some categories like supplements and nutritions, you'll see 80% margins on that type of a business.
80% EBITDA margins.
Gross margins.
Okay. Me.
So, but then, I mean, those things can carry EBITDA margins of 35 to 40% because there's just not that much overhead,
right.
You know, and they're cheap to ship. And so that's kind of the high water mark. And again, that's why you see a lot of really robust valuation multiples, you know, 20 times EBITDA for high growth businesses and that, you know, with consumable features in that kind of a bucket. And then a kind of a more typical like products business, maybe a durable products or, you know, housewares, kitchenwares, or even apparel. Generally those gross margins are going to range between, you know, 45 at the low end up to 60%. And that should translate into a fully burdened EBITDA margin of, you know, between 15 and 25%. So that's what I would say is, you know, a high quality business. Certainly there are other strategies where, you know, maybe you strategically price a little bit lower and you're willing to trade some margin for volume. And if that's the brand strategy, then that also is it's a coherent strategy that you can articulate. And, you know, I think certainly not have your alternatives impeded, but the bottom line is, you know, why do people go direct to consumer? You know, why is that a sound business strategy? Well, it's because of the margin recapture opportunity that you would otherwise be giving up to the wholesaler and the retailer. You know, if you were going through a conventional two-step distribution.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that, but I just want to finish off the kind of valuation conversation because so many people are interested in it. So if the high margin supplement business, let's say, that is doing a 45% EBITDA margin, and you said a multiple in that range would be a 20x on that? Is that right?
So let's dive in a little bit deeper to some trends in the market.
Yeah.
What you're seeing here, and maybe I'll back up for a second and give you a macro view of the M&A landscape, because it's been super active in the last 2 years. We've been crazy busy. You know, our firm, it was a record year for us in terms of the amount of deals that we closed last year. And we think 2022 is just going to be equally as active, if not more.
That's
so
great.
Really good time to be a seller. If that's what you are. And what's driving that? There's a couple of key factors that affect our business, which is really privately held, you know, M&A. Number one is that there is an incredibly frothy environment in the private capital markets. And so what I mean there is really your traditional middle market private equity. People hear a lot about that. What does that mean? Basically, professional investment managers who are raising money from institutional limited partners like insurance companies, endowments, pension funds, the like, they want to get exposure to private companies because that's where the potential for real, you know, significant growth and outsized returns is. It's hard to find a lot of attractive returns in the markets these days that are steady and consistent over a 5 to 10 year time horizon. Yeah, the public markets will go up and they'll go down, but you certainly can't bank on generating, you know, 20% annual return if all you're investing in is public equities. So that's driven a lot of interest in private equity as an alternative. And so as these big institutional limited partners have been increasing their allocations to the private equity asset class, you've got a bunch of funds that are just raising tons of capital. Mm-hmm. And that means they need to invest it. You know, the dirty little secret of the private equity world is that for you to get paid your management fees on your capital, you've got to be deploying that capital actively. Mm-hmm. And so there's about $840 billion of private equity capital that has, you know, yet to be invested, but has been allocated over the last 2 to 3 years.
Wow.
Chasing deals. And you know, what I'm talking about there is capital that's focused on sub-$1 billion transactions. So that's, you know, a lot of that is going after opportunities in the lower middle market. Mm-hmm. And so that sets your baseline because you kind of know that if you've got attractive attributes about your business and you've got a solid team, you're always going to be able to go out and find a private equity buyer who will, you know, pay you fair market value. So what we try to do at Cascadia is really go after, you know, that very tailored custom storytelling when we position a company to the market that makes your business a gotta have. And our goal is to find that sort of spike bid that's, mm-hmm. that's going to lead to an above market outcome for our clients. So let me then kind of bring it back to your original question about where are you seeing valuations? Yeah. There are certain things that become trends, and you know, when a deal gets done and somebody makes a really good investment and generates a return, the market notices and they look for the next thing that's very similar. And so that's happened in, you know, consumable deals recently because they're so great for just an e-commerce model for the reasons mm-hmm. I mentioned. You know, you can generate super high gross margins, it's lightweight, it's easy to ship, you've got good repeat purchase behavior because it's a consumable product and people keep coming back. And so that's one particular pocket where you're seeing, you know, deal after deal and people are chasing it. And you've really seen multiples drive up over the last several years. Mm-hmm. But there's other good examples as well of, you know, certain sectors. But yeah, I mean, I think the high water mark in that industry, you know, whether it's for humans or for pets, has been, you know, about a 20x multiple on an exit for that type of a business.
Wow.
But I would say that is a little bit of an outlier.
Right.
To be fair, and you know, for the audience to not overinflate what right. this is might be worth.
Well, let's just so a 20x multiple, like what, a 45% EBITDA margin, the consumable space, and what type of revenue growth would that company have, you know, to achieve that high of a multiple?
Yeah, I mean, for that type of a frothy, you know, growth story multiple, you're probably looking at between, you know, 30% to 50%.
Okay.
Growth.
Okay. I thought you were going to say something like 300%, but okay.
I mean, it depends on scale too, right?
Right.
Like these businesses have to have enough scale that there's meaningful cash flows there, right?
Yeah.
When you're investing or, you know, looking to deploy $100 million of equity per transaction, you know, you can kind of do the math. If you're paying a 20x, like you've got to, and when you introduce leverage a little bit, you know, you need 10 million plus of EBITDA to sort of justify that.
Right. And then if you walk down like to the other end of the range, mm-hmm. you'd mentioned durables or apparel. You know, let's say somebody's trading, you know, doing a 15% EBITDA margin. like where could they expect to trade?
Yeah, you know, I would say that what the market, where the market is right now, is going to range from kind of high single digit multiples for a good growth story up to 14, 15 times, you know, depending on the attributes. So, you know, directionally with broad strokes and, you know, not getting into a specific company per se, that's where we've seen deals land recently. You know, if you're checking all the boxes and you've got a nice growth story, there's definitely buyers out there that'll pay you 11, 12, 13x for that business.
Interesting. And how much has that changed in the past year? I was sort of surprised when you said, you know, 21 was great. Like, okay, that, you know, that's well known, but that you are seeing 22 lining up to be as equally good, if not better. So have those multiples shifted over the past year or so, or have they remained sort of steady?
Multiples have been pretty steady for the last, you know, 12 months or so. And that was one of the really interesting things that we saw, you know, when the pandemic sort of reached its onset and in Q2 2020, everyone was wondering, oh my goodness, what's going on with multiples? Like, are you going to see a bunch of just valuation compression? And yeah, there were some distress situations where, you know, people got really good deals because the business was just not appropriately capitalized. But that's not the story of the market. By and large, valuations have been pretty steady and pretty, you know, on a historical basis. So if you compare it to 10 years ago, pretty elevated. And they've been staying there. And we haven't seen that change too significantly at all. You know, I think the biggest risk in the e-commerce space, and it's kind of binary if you're a seller, right? Because you can either, you know, it may not be the right time to sell your business if you don't have the right trends supporting that narrative. And so one of the big themes that people are focused on right now is, you know, maybe they're seeing some decelerating growth because 2020 and 2021, you know, were really big growth years driven by channel shift to online, you know, everyone staying at home and four-wall retail being closed. And then obviously, you know, consumer spending and, you know, some of the stimulus benefits from government policy were a part of that as well in some discretionary categories. And so people are looking at really tough comps in 2022. And so I wouldn't say that it's, you know, a universal growth year for people, but from the clients that I'm talking to and the business owners that, you know, I'm out there talking with on a daily basis, we're certainly still seeing people who are comping positive over 2021 and continuing to grow really nicely.
It's interesting. There seems to be, you're telling a very positive story, and you know, you go read stuff in the press or whatever, and there's a lot of like, people are worried about, you know, these recently public D2C companies, you know, they're missing earnings, the share prices are way down. Our index shows that, right? You hear anecdotally about it's much harder for these guys to raise VC money. So what is the impact of the public market performance on, you know, your business, on M&A? I would have thought there'd be a more direct connection, but it doesn't seem to be that way. Or what am I missing?
Yeah, so really good question, Ben. And it's no secret, the public markets have sold off. There's a litany of factors that go into that. And I think some of those deals that got done last year in the public space were done at valuations that they never should have been done at. I mean, I traffic in the space. I've got a stock portfolio. I probably wouldn't have bought some of those IPOs or SPAC deals at the prices that they went public at. And I think if you were paying attention, you could probably tell that there were some issues around the growth prospects. And it doesn't surprise me at all that the valuations have come back down to earth a little bit. Now, you're also in an environment on the public side where there's a lot of other factors that are beating these stocks down around, you know, interest rate risk and the implications there on sort of the discount rate for the future growth prospects, and then just kind of bearish sentiment in the public markets because of things like, you know, ongoing supply chain risk, global macro uncertainties and things like that. So, and I'm not a stockbroker, I'm not recommending, you know, stock picks here, but have some of these things sold off a little bit too much? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting is that we really think that the public and private markets are relatively decoupled. They, you know, you've got a lot of the institutions that are long-term holders in the public markets, but the reality is a lot of the day-to-day volatility is driven by traders and hedge funds and things like that who are moving in and out and you know, trying to generate returns through trading as opposed to through and you know, picking the right spots and buying things right and looking for arbitrage opportunities as opposed to more durable growth stories where that's what, you know, in the lower middle market, private markets, that's where people are generating their returns. And so they're taking a 3, 4, 5 year time horizon over these investments. And that tends to provide a little bit more price stability in the M&A world. Because frankly, what you did in, you know, 1 month or 1 quarter doesn't really change the long-term growth trajectory if you're still putting up double digit growth year over year and you know, you're at the scale that we're talking about. So long-winded answer to your question, but the markets are more decoupled than people would think. And certainly you know, it does inform perspective, but like I said, there's still this underlying positive tailwind in the private markets because folks are looking to increase their allocations of investment dollars that really has helped support the overall market health.
Yeah. It sounds like your base of buyership, I don't want to lead the question too much, but there's a private investor buyership. What other buyership would there be for a D2C brand? Who else are you guys going out to?
Sure. So a few different key buckets that people like to think about. So again, depending on the characteristics and the potential for an omni-channel story and some of the other growth attributes, private equity is always a very interesting buyer population. And there's a lot of different flavors of these types of investment groups. But I think everybody recognizes that the long-term macro trends are favoring, you know, non-store retail, and that what I always tell people is that over the next 10 years, the one thing I'm fairly certain is that people are going to be buying more online, not less.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one group. Now, obviously there's also a whole universe of companies that have been in business for a long time, but are looking to increase their exposure or their penetration to the e-commerce channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you're targeting that population, you really look for a couple of different factors. And mm-hmm. one would be the strategic fit with a brand inside of an existing portfolio. You know, or a capabilities-based approach. So what can you bring from, whether it's digital marketing or some kind of bolt-on product feature that really makes sense and is going to help to turbocharge growth, because it is an attractive channel. But there's always that buy versus build story, because it's no secret that, you know, these trends are out there, and the larger strategic companies or strategic buyers, as we call them, so operating companies, have also been making pretty significant investments in growing their own business organically. It's not like they've just been asleep at the wheel for the last few years.
Right.
And then, you know, there's a third bucket of buyers out there, which are a little bit of a blend of the two. And this has been a really interesting trend that's arisen over the last 3 years or so. And that's kind of direct-to-consumer and e-commerce aggregators. And there's been a lot of press about them. They've raised a lot of capital to go out and acquire brands. And they all have a little bit of a different flavor. Some of them are very platform focused, looking for, you know, Amazon, third-party sellers. Some of them take a little bit of a broader view and will look for brands that have e-commerce as their primary channel, but, you know, maybe fit within a more coherent or cohesive category theme. And, you know, Solo Brands is one that is on everyone's radar, who has done this in a very interesting fashion. And, you know, to bring it back to what we were talking about earlier, saw a really attractive, you know, entry into the public markets, but hasn't been able to sustain that over the last 4 or 5 months, as some of the things outside of their control and some of the just realities of growth in the market have started to weigh on them. By the way, that's one of the risks of the public market exit, is once you go there, the value of your company tends to be a little bit out of your control.
Right. So you mentioned earlier, you know, whether you're on trend or not on trend. How do you know if you're on trend? Like, what, for an entrepreneur, you know, how do they know that they might be the right trend in a now or in a year or two? And how would you know that you're out of favor?
Well, look, I can't predict what consumers are going to want to do and, you know, what the next hot brand is going to be. But what I can tell you is that if you're an entrepreneur or a business owner, you know, the market will find you. And if you've got a really quality product and a brand that resonates with folks, you're going to hear about it and you're going to see it in the demand. Right. And so that's the great differentiator for being able to start something direct to consumer and online, is that you can engage directly with your customers. You can get that end user feedback in real time, whether it's on social or, you know, through your own website interactions or polls and, you know, just customer engagements. And that's been a huge change from the legacy model, where you do some focus groups and, you know, you'd develop a really cool idea or what you thought was a good idea, and then you'd go sell it into retail and it'd get on the shelf and it would either sink or swim. So I think, look, you've always got to be experimenting and tweaking your product and, you know, trying to improve it. But really listening to your customer feedback is probably the best insights that you're going to glean on whether you're capturing the right trends or not.
What about the trends in the buyership, though? It sounded like when you're talking about the supplement space and private investors, that, you know, this became popular as a kind of thesis, right? Like consumables, the low shipping cost, the high margin, you know, that's probably, everybody talks about that now, but, you know, are there signs in the market that the private buyers are starting to develop a new thesis? Or is it just like somebody hears about a great deal and all of a sudden it's like, let's do more of those. And then there's a rush to do the next, you know, deal 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah. So a couple of thoughts on that. You know, one, what are the attributes that any, you know, simplistic investor can get their heads around? If it's a consumable product, it's going to lend itself to repeat purchase. So you pay to acquire the customer once, and as long as you've got a good product, they're gonna keep coming back. So they love consumables across categories. Number two, you know, is it something that is reasonable to fulfill? Because that's your other big cost. In your direct to consumer model. And so that's a second thing that they like to look at. And then number three is, from a SKU assortment standpoint, you know, can you manage your inventory, and how do you see that challenge over time? And so, for example, when you get into things like soft goods and apparel, some investors push back on those types of businesses, because all of a sudden, instead of having, you know, a green shirt and that being one SKU, you've got a green shirt in 5 sizes, and that's 5 SKUs out of the gate, and your inventory management becomes a much bigger headache when you're dealing with things that have multiple SKU vectors. So that's, I think, the simplistic way to take a look at, you know, are you going to be on trend? I don't see those trends changing too dramatically. What I do see changing, and this is an area where I've been spending a lot of time, is businesses that have a differentiated supply chain approach to marry up with their direct-to-consumer and e-commerce channel. And so one of the big issues in the industry over the last year has been supply chain. You can't, and particularly where you're manufacturing product overseas and then importing it, it sounds great, you know, and again, the demand side has been tremendous, but if you can't get the product, or you can't get the product in time, it doesn't really do you any good. And so we're seeing a big shift back towards, you know, more domestic production and on-demand manufacturing to support businesses that are e-commerce first. And so that has been one area where, you know, buyers have really been scrutinizing your supply chain. How much exposure do you have to China? How much exposure do you have, you know, to other geographies in Asia? Could you find Western Hemisphere sourcing? Could you find domestic sourcing? Right. What are the implications on cost going to be? I'm personally a big believer that you're going to see, with the advances in manufacturing and technology, you're going to see a big shift and migration, particularly in the textiles industry, back towards onshore production, because the benefits from an inventory standpoint that you can gain from being closer to your end customer and being able to produce much better to meet your real-time demand are going to be so tremendous, you know, with respect to protecting your gross margins, because you're not going to be tying up capital with excess inventory. You're not going to have to discount and, you know, liquidate product as much. And that's the real advantage of going direct, is that you have that visibility into real-time demand. But it's really challenging if you're reliant on 9-month lead times. Yeah. And you've placed your POs today, you know, on March 29th, hoping that you can, you know, sell something in the holiday season. That goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago around, what is the level of consumer sentiment about your businesses? So that's something that a lot of people don't necessarily think about all the time when they start an e-commerce business. They tend to come up with an interesting product, an interesting brand. And then, you know, they go figure out how to source it and go find it and, you know, get product in a warehouse and start selling it. It hooks in a little bit with the talk around consumables, whether it's, you know, food, beverage or supplements, et cetera. Because that stuff does tend to be produced in the United States. And so it's benefiting from some of those trends I was just talking about.
That's really interesting. Might save the apparel business.
Well, I mean, that's another truism. I think people will be buying more things online in 10 years, and I still think they'll be wearing clothes.
Yeah. What, sort of switching gears to the deal side, what are some of the biggest mistakes you see founders or, you know, sellers making in a process?
Sure. So, you know, one thing that we see is people who don't want to let enough buyers into their process. There's kind of a couple schools of thought, and one is that you've got a lot of proprietary data in the direct-to-consumer space, and you don't want to give your competitors access to too much data. But at the same time, to find an efficient market, you know, you do need to get out there and market your business. And look, the reality is it can be time consuming and it can be distracting for a management team or an owner. So that tends to lend itself to, you know, maybe not getting a complete view of the market. So that's a great example of a time when you should hire an investment banker to offload a lot of that heavy lifting and handle, you know, your buyer dialogues and recommend sort of the ecosystem that you should talk to. So I think that's one just easy way to stub your toe is, you know, taking the first offer or not talking to enough folks and testing enough buyer populations.
What data are they particularly worried about? I mean, is this like the customer files, or is it more just like, here's my margin structure and my repeat purchase rates and stuff like that?
It's both. I mean, I think really easy to do a customer overlay with your customer file, but obviously, you know, do you really want, particularly if you're talking to a competitor or, you know, a strategic who's in an adjacent space, do you really want to make that information available? And so you've got to stage things and you've got to mask the data and do certain analyses, but, you know, that's one issue. And then the second issue is, again, around supply chain, because there's always the risk that somebody could just go knock you off and, you know, go around you, source from the same supplier. There is a little bit of a, and this is kind of funny, right? Sometimes you do see some concerns about, could your supplier just go direct and you know, cut you out? In my experience, that just doesn't happen. These businesses aren't equipped to, manufacturing businesses, particularly internationally, are not equipped to address the U.S. consumer and you know, effectively operate e-commerce platforms over here. But that's a question that we do get some from time to time. So I thought I'd mention it.
How well prepared financially are your sellers? Are they often, you know, the books are in order, they've got great models, they really understand the numbers, or is there like, it can be a mess, is it sort of self-selecting? Like somebody, if they're not ready, they're not ready and you don't take them on.
I would say that the truth of the matter is that probably, you know, more of our clients are a little bit messier from a financial control standpoint than you would like to see. And part of what we try to do is, you know, hook up the entrepreneurs that we're talking with well before they ever get to a transaction with a group like yours or you know, just a high quality sort of bookkeeping or accounting firm that's going to be able to provide better controls and better reporting. Look, entrepreneurs by their nature don't want to invest heavily in non-revenue facing functions. So they've got to be able to see the ROI. And when you're just saying, hey, you need to add finance staff, they push back and say, right. Well, what's that going to cost? I can look at the data. But it's true that the more buttoned up you are going into a process, the better your company is going to present to buyers. And there is a direct correlation with valuation, because the perception of the company is, you know, very important when you're out there, and people want to think that, or people will believe that if you've got well-prepared financials, a very clean, you know, professional looking model, it's a well-run operation in other facets that aren't as readily visible to a buyer on the surface.
We've heard that anecdotally, that oftentimes sellers or people that are out raising money are completely outclassed in terms of their financial modeling and data analytics by the PE firms. You know, the PE firms will come in with much more sophisticated models, much more sophisticated analyses, and sometimes are even teaching the company things about their own company, which I guess there's a benefit, but it's also a painful position to be in. You know, the buyer knows more about your business than you do. That's not a great place to be.
Again, I totally agree with you. And I think that's why it's so important to get those things addressed ahead of time and be working with, you know, third parties that are knowledgeable. If you're considering selling your business in the next few years, because it's absolutely critical. You've got so much data at your fingertips with a direct-to-consumer model that you really want to be able to be having actionable insights and using that data to drive your business. You don't want to be in a position where a buyer comes back and, you know, is pointing out things about your company that you intuitively knew, but you didn't have a handle on with data.
Yeah.
The other point I would make is that once you do go to sell your business and you get in the market, time is not your friend. You want to move quickly and swiftly. And the best way to do that, again, from a control standpoint, is to have very tight financial reporting, a tight data package, and a handle on everything so that you can get through the due diligence process and not get bogged down. You had asked what can go wrong. Well, that is a big piece of it that can go wrong. If you get bogged down in due diligence, there's nothing but risks as a seller. Very rarely is a buyer going to come back to you after they've gone through the due diligence process and say, hey, we'd like to give you a positive purchase price adjustment.
That's a great point. The more time you give people to think about something, the more reasons they can come up with not to do it, and things change. And yeah, that's a terrific point.